Let's pick up our story in the big book of beginnings, the book of Genesis, chapter number 9, verse number 18 today. This is the story of how the world gets repopulated. How this one family is able to begin the human race all over again and haul all the different kinds of animals that were on the ark could then leave this area and spread out and provide all of the variants that we see in the animal world today. Genesis 9:18 says, "The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth." Now, Shem is listed first always because this is the story of the Messiah race that brings the Messiah into the world, and that would be the Shemite race. And so he is the first in the names here. Now, Ham was the father of Canaan. The reason that is brought up is because of the next story. God wants us to understand why the Canaanites were under a special curse when the Israelites, who are reading this for the very first time, the book of Genesis, when the Israelites go into the promised land, the Canaanites are under the curse of God where they have to leave the country or be executed for trying to stay. And so this is going to be part of the explanation as to the moral character of the Canaanites in the time that the book of Genesis was written. Verse number 19. These three, that'd be Shem, Ham, and Japheth, were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. We'll come back to that topic after this quick story. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. Now, he may have been a farmer before the flood, but we can't be certain of that. Because remember, it's been, according to the Septuagint's numbers, over 2 millennia since the beginning of creation. And in those 2 millennia, there could have been a lot of technologies developed. And some of them perhaps even more advanced than the technologies we have today on planet Earth. Because keep in mind, the people living before the flood didn't get interrupted by short lifetimes. They were living into their 900s on average. If you could imagine smart guys, smart women, that accomplished an awful lot in 80 years, imagine what they would have accomplished in 800 years. So whatever it was that Noah did before the flood, after the flood, he's a farmer. And so he plants himself a vineyard, grapevines. And then it says he drank of the wine and he became drunk. Now, before you jump all over his case, I want you to keep in mind that we've known before the flood that he was a man of righteousness, a man who was blameless in his generation, a man who followed God's directives and rules. So he is not the type of guy you would expect to get drunk on purpose. So is there the possibility that he might have got drunk on accident? And I say, yes, I think so. Remember that the world has changed radically. With the flood, the huge vapor canopy that we presume was in place is gone. We also know that the soils have all changed because most of the topsoil is now in the bottom of the oceans. And the seasons, the climate, is going to be different in different plots or parts of the world now. During the early part after the flood, the early time after the flood, the world was probably experiencing this huge instability called the Ice Age. There weren't ice ages over hundreds of thousands of years, but rather one big period, probably a couple of hundred years after the flood, of great instability as the earth tries to find its balance again. And so you've got lots and lots of water that ends up with being locked up in cold because of the storms that are sweeping over the planet. And so we have ice sheets. And of course, in some places, we have desert areas where it's really hot and dry. And so all of that is starting to, you know, pop up all over planet Earth and sweep around in different places. So you've got different climate zones. So you don't know, you know, how crops are going to fare just yet until all of that settles down to the standard that I think we look at today. So don't get too self-righteous in thinking that Noah is being a bad boy here. It could be that grapes and fermentation all take place differently in the post-flood world than they did previous to the flood. You know, there's some creation scientists that have evidence and teaching that even the atmosphere's makeup of oxygen was different previous to the flood and after the flood, that there is much less oxygen today than there was before. And so even how you process food is going to be different in the post-flood world. So I am just offering you my opinion here. I think the poor man drank the first vintage of the new world thinking that it was exactly like the vintage of the old world, and he ended up being slammed by the change in the way his body processed it. And he ends up getting falling down drunk. And it says that he lay uncovered in his tent. Then comes the next part of the story. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Now, the implication is not as clear in the English as I think it is in the Hebrew or even in the Greek. That effectively, Ham was actually talking about his father to his two brothers. And apparently, he was saying some pretty rude things, some crude and suggestive things. And this is the Jewish tradition, by the way, that you can read about. I think in Josephus, he has some comments about this. So Ham apparently is not a good guy. He's got a bad attitude. Now, that bad attitude probably existed previous to the flood. It's just being more and more obvious after the flood. And this is a component of free will. Everybody has free will to be both good or bad. And Ham, I'm afraid to say, might be one of the bad guys. So he's speaking some bad things about his dad, perhaps even some sexual innuendo. And then Shem and Japheth took a garment, they laid it on both their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. So they tried to show respect to their poor, inebriated dad. And again, this is another indication. This has not happened before. This is not a regular thing. This is something strange and unusual. And so the two brothers try to make dad less embarrassed. Verse 24, when Noah woke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him. And this is where we find out that Ham is the youngest of the three, even though his name appears second in most of the lists, Shem, Ham, Japheth. And it's probably because Shem appears first because of his significance in the Messiah line. Ham probably appears second because of his connection to the Canaanites and the curse that we're about to read. So no one knows what happened. How does he know? Possibly God brought him up to speed because Noah is counted as a prophet. He has supernatural insight. But his two better sons may have informed him as what had happened. Notice it says here what his youngest son had done to him. Again, some sort of mockery, some sort of inappropriate suggestions, perhaps sexual innuendos that should not have been uttered, let alone thought. And so he says, and I believe this is to be looked at as prophetic utterance, the Holy Spirit of God working through him predicts what the future holds for at least part of this genetic line. And it may be related to the bad attitude that Ham has, which will then be passed down through bad teaching. He said, "Cursed be Canaan. The servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." Now, Canaan is probably just a kid at this time, probably born very shortly after the flood to Ham and his wife. But Noah sees to the future when Canaan is not just simply a little boy, but rather a genetic group, an entire ethnic group that seems to be living the same sort of bad thinking lifestyle that Ham has demonstrated here. And what do we know about the Canaanites? Well, in the time of Abraham, they were called the Amorites. And God told Abraham, "I'm not going to give this land to your descendants until the sin of the Canaanites or the sin of the Amorites is to its fullness. That is, it's complete, total, can't go any longer without being punished limit." And so the Canaanites were some bad people. You know what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. We haven't got to that story yet, but most of you are well aware of it. They were so sinful that not even 10 decent people could be found in the entire population, and that was starting with Lot and his family members as being kind of a core to that small number. Couldn't even find a handful, we would say, of righteous people. They were that bad. Well, that was in the time of Abraham. That was a small group of Canaanites that were that bad. And we know that they were engaged in things like selfishness, abuse of the poor. They were also very much involved in the wild sexual exploits of, homosexuality and experimenting in things like that. Well, in the days of the Israelis coming out of Egypt, all of the Canaanites had started vying for that same sort of level of sinfulness that Sodom and Gomorrah had had 400 plus years earlier. So what's being predicted here is that the descendants of this line, the Ham through Canaan line, is going to be really bad. And some of them that survive the coming of the Israelis into the land are going to end up becoming the slaves or servants of the Israelis that will come through the Shem line. And they'll also be servants to those coming through the Japheth line. So this is not a curse saying this has to happen. It's basically, this is prophetic information. This is what's going to happen. Verse 26, he also said, "Blessed be he who is the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." Now remember, the divine name did not exist in the time of Noah. This is Moses writing into the text here saying, the God that we're following to the promised land, he's the God that's being blessed in this story. So Shem, the Shemites, the Israelis, they're going to have Canaanites as their servants. And that comes to pass, particularly about the Gibeonite story. We'll talk about that once we get to the time of the conquest of the promised land. Verse 27, may God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem and let Canaan be his servant. So because Japheth and Shem were acting together on behalf of Noah, they are going to have that same sort of attitude that they will instill into their young people. And hopefully some of that will remain in place through many, many generations later. And Shem and Japheth will have connections with each other. Japheth ends up effectively being the line through which most of the Europeans come into existence. And there has been a very large number of Europeans that have embraced the gospel of Jesus Christ, which comes from the Shemite line. And so that might be part of what's being predicted here. We're ready now, after that story, to go into the genealogies. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So he lives a good long time, several centuries after the flood is finished. He, I think, may have in fact still been alive when all the foolishness that leads to the Tower of Babel starts percolating to the top. Verse number 1 of chapter 10. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. So this is one of our Toledoth passages. This is one of the natural divisions for the entire book. It lets us know we're now going to talk about the story of how these three men became the beginning of different people groups that will be in existence at the time of the Tower of Babel. Now, why do I say that? Because these ethnic groups will eventually represent different language groups that will spread out from the Tower of Babel and give rise to other language groups underneath them, so that we kind of have languages that are arranged in families. So we start with Japheth as the first name on our list, and it might be because he's the eldest. The sons of Japheth, and what I'm going to do, and it might be helpful for you if you've got a nice map of the old world, that would be the Middle East radiating outward into Europe and Africa and off into Asia. Because I'm going to mention where these people groups end up going after the Tower of Babel. So the sons of Japheth, they are Gomer. And Gomer seems to be in the area of what's Turkey today. Magog is also in the area of Turkey. And Magog plays a part in the story of the Gog-Magog War. Magog seems to mean from Gog, or the land of Gog, and Gog itself seems to be a reference to the Shining One, which is another name for Satan. Again, this is somewhere in the area of what we call Turkey, or the related countries to the east of Turkey. Madai is the next one on this list. Yavin, Tuvel, Meshech, Tiras, all these places in the upper Middle East. Now, the sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, and that's where the Ashkenazi Jews are kind of related in. Riffeth and Togarma. Again, some of the same areas of the Middle East. The sons of Yavin, Elisha, Tarshish. Now, we know where Tarshish is. It's on the northeast corner of the Mediterranean. It was the hometown of none other than Paul. Kittim, which I believe is the name for the island of Cyprus. And Dodanim. So these are all the sons of Yavin. And from these, the coastland peoples spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans in their nations. And so the Japhethites seem to move eastward from the Tower of Babel later and take over Europe and the northern Mediterranean region. Now, verse 7 says, the sons of verse 6, the sons of Ham, and this would be the youngest son of Noah, Cush. Now, Cush is the way that you say Ethiopia in Hebrew, but it's also the name of a place in Mesopotamia. So it's possible that both are in mind. So Cush, Egypt, which used to be called Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. So immediately you can start seeing that these things are on the eastern side of the Mediterranean, in Mesopotamia, down through the land bridge into Africa. And so these are where the Hamites are going to settle. The sons of Cush, Sheba, Hawilah. Now, Sheba seems to be down to the south. It's probably where modern-day Yemen is. Hawilah seems to be the Sinai Peninsula. Sabta, Ra'ama, Sabtaka, the sons of Ra'ama, Sheba and Dadan. Again, Sheba probably down to the south of the Arabian Peninsula. Cush fathered Nimrod, and he was the first on earth to be a mighty man. Now, Cush, remember I told you, is the name for Hebrew Ethiopia, but it's also the name of Mesopotamia area called Cush. And so Nimrod, who is the very famous person in this list, becomes the first big leader in Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is the land of the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. So he becomes this big boss of the Mesopotamian region. He was a mighty hunter before he who is, and therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before he who is. The beginnings of his kingdom were Babel, so he more than likely, and this is what the tradition says, Nimrod more than likely was the guy that built the Tower of Babel as part of his trying to consolidate his authority over that part of the world. Erech, which is also a kingdom in Mesopotamia, Akkad, and the Akkadians come from that, and Kalna in the land of Shinar. So Shinar is the place where the Tower of Babylon gets built. So Nimrod is all about that Mesopotamian area. From that land, he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, which Mosul, modern-day Mosul, is where Nineveh used to be. Rehoboth, Ir, Kalna, and Rezin between Nineveh and Kalna. That is the great city. So we'll be talking about Nimrod some more when we get to the Tower of Babel. But I want you to see now that when the Tower of Babel takes place, we've got the Shemites, or excuse me, the Cushites are all, or the Hamites are stretched from Mesopotamia down into North Africa. That's their swath of the world. And then the Japhethites are going to be from Armenia and places like that eastward toward Europe. Now, that leaves us then with the Shemites. Where are they going to be at? And they're going to kind of be in Mesopotamia, but also in other locations. But we're out of time today, so we will mark our place right here. And when we come back next week, this is where we will get into the Word.